Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. Vedic by KJ Heritage. The dead don't always die. Top company scientist Chin Jelinek has committed suicide. Vedic, a half-alive empath with no memory of who or what he is, will die in 6 hours if he can't find out why, or so the company tells him, an added incentive to get the job done. Our hero soon discovers he is one of the skilled, a genetically enhanced human revered and despised in equal measure, a bloodhound with a terrifying past who'll stop at nothing in his pursuit of the truth. And the skilled always get their guy, don't they? Vedic, number one, by KJ Heritage, on sale now. There's a link to it in the show notes. KJ Heritage's uncanny sense of pacing and story puts him at the forefront of today's speculative fiction writers. Gritty, intense, and compelling, Vedic is something you don't run into often enough in sci-fi, a cerebral thrill ride you don't want to end. Prepare to lose sleep reading Vedic, delicious science fiction. That's what other people are saying about it. Find out for yourself. Vedic, the first book in the series by KJ Heritage. Jasper T. Scott. His box set Dark Space, the complete series. This is 6 books bundled together on sale now for 99 cents. 6 complete books, over 600,000 copies sold. More than 2,000 pages of epic space opera for the low price of 99 cents. Also available in Kindle Unlimited if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber. Humanity is defeated. 10 years ago, the Scythians invaded the galaxy with one goal, to wipe out the human race. Now the survivors are hiding in the last human sector of the galaxy, Dark Space, once a place of exile for criminals, now the last refuge of mankind. The once galaxy-spanning Imperium of Star Systems is left guarding the gate, which is the only way in or out of Dark Space, but not everyone is satisfied with their governance. Freelancer and ex-convict Ethan Ortain is on the run. He owes crime lord Alec Barandi 10,000 souls, and his ship is badly damaged. When Barandi catches up with him, he makes an offer Ethan can't refuse. Ethan must infiltrate and sabotage the Valiant, the Imperial Star System's fleet carrier which stands guarding the entrance of Dark Space, and then his debt will be cleared. While Ethan is still undecided about what he'll do, he realizes that the Imperium has been lying and putting all of Dark Space at risk. Now Brondi's plan is starting to look like a necessary evil, but before Ethan can act on it, he discovers that the real plan was much more sinister than what he was told, and he will be lucky to escape the Valiant alive. Grab all 6 books for 99 cents right now. Dark Space, the complete series by Jasper T. Scott. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. Survivor, Mother, Leader, and Humanity's Last Chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the Unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the Cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the Unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them, but now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the Cursed have been targeted by the Unwelcome slowly comes to light, and that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the Cursed who are being hunted down by the Unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have J.A. Jantz on the show with me today. She is the author of the long-running J.P. Beaumont series, also the Joanna Brady series, a series of standalones, and much, much more. Welcome to the show, J.A.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
It's actually very clear to me. In second grade, my teacher, Mrs. Spangler, had a shelf over under the windows, and if you finished your work early, you could go over and select one of those books to take back to your desk to read. And it was among Mrs. Spangler's books that I found the Wizard of Oz books. And I wasn't the least bit interested in the wizard, but what fascinated me was the fact that there was a person standing behind the words, and I wanted to be the person who wrote those words and put words on the pages. An interesting thing happened about 7 years ago now. I was in Tucson for the Tucson Festival of Books, and a TV station sent a crew out to interview me, and the cameraman turned out to be Mrs. Spangler's grandson, and he inherited all of his grandmother's books. So it was really wonderful to be able to tell him what a difference having his grandmother in second grade made in my whole life.
Oh, that's so amazing. That is so amazing. You know, I've heard a similar story to that from a few people. The idea that, you know, at one point in your life, it seems like books just kind of magically show up. And then there's that moment when you realize that there are people behind the books, and that changes everything, doesn't it?
Right. It really does.
So how did you, you know, once that idea is kind of awakened in you and you realize that you want to be the person telling the stories, as you get older and progress through school and then, you know, out of school, how do you start chasing that dream?
Well, I was chasing the dream. I won a scholarship to the University of Arizona. I signed up to be an English major. And my junior year, 1964, I tried to enroll in the creative writing program. And the professor, I was working in the English department, and I was putting up mail. And the professor came in, and I said, I'd like to enroll in your class this fall. And he looked at me, and he said, you're a girl. I said, so.
Oh, my gosh.
He said, girls become teachers or nurses, boys become writers. He wouldn't let me into his class. So I became first an English teacher, and then I became a librarian.
That's the sound of incredulous laughter all through the audience.
Well, the thing is, I married a guy who was allowed in the creative writing program that was closed to me. He never published anything. He imitated Faulkner and Hemingway by drinking too much and writing too little. He died of chronic alcoholism at age 42. But that didn't keep him from telling me in 1968, there's only going to be one writer in our family, and I'm it. And so I didn't start writing until I was 40 years old. I was a divorced single woman with two little kids and a full-time job selling life insurance. And the only time I had that was mine was from 4 o'clock in the morning until 7 when I got the kids up to get ready to go to school and me ready to go sell life insurance. And that's how I wrote my first three books, writing from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the morning.
That is unreal. That's a story that's hard to fathom in the world we live in today. Well, one thing, it's a horrible story in your case and the things that you had to put up with and go through. But it's also a great story of perseverance and the idea that even though all of these people told you no, you were going to do it anyway. Do you remember what that feeling was like of being told no, but knowing that you were going to do it anyway?
Well, I at the time I was in college, I didn't know I was going to do it anyway. I finally started doing it, and it is a horrible story. But you know what? My first nine books were original paperbacks. The first book I ever wrote, from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the morning, was never published because it was 1,400 pages long.
You had a lot to say, didn't you?
But my first hardback was a book called Hour of the Hunter. And you know what? It's the story of a woman who's a teacher on an Indian reservation, but she really wants to be a writer. Like me, she had a husband who was allowed in a creative writing program that was closed to her. He's dead at the beginning of the book. And the crazed killer turns out to be a former professor of creative writing for the University of Arizona. So, you know, I got even.
Things work out, don't they?
And of all of my books, Hour of the Hunter is one of two. If I pick that book up to look up some detail because I'm writing another Walker book, that's a book that will draw me in and I will have to read the whole book. The stories and legends I learned as a storyteller on the Tohono O'odham are the real stories and legends of the desert people. And those are stories I learned as a storyteller while working as a librarian on a reservation.
Tell me more about that 1,400-page book that you wrote from 4 to 7 in the morning. What after writing that book, and I'm assuming you didn't sell it, What did writing that book teach you that helped you in later and subsequent books?
Well, it taught me how to write. I hadn't done a book before. I wasn't allowed in the creative writing program. So I wrote a thinly fictionalized version of an encounter my first husband and I had with a serial killer in Tucson in 1970. And in the course of writing that book, I learned how to do expository writing. I learned how to write dialogue. I learned how to do pacing. I learned all of those tools that you need to have to write suspense fiction. I was lucky enough to find an agent. I went to see her. And I had the box with me, and she looked at the box, and she said, "This is your first manuscript?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "It's too long. Cut it in half." So I did. Excuse me. I took it back to her. She tried to sell it, and the editors who turned it down told her that the parts that were fiction were fine, and the parts that were real were unbelievable and would never happen, even though those things already had happened. So she told me that I needed to write something that was completely fiction. So I wrote the first Beaumont book, Until Proven Guilty. I think a lot of writers make a really serious error if they're lucky enough to land an agent on their first manuscript, and the agent is unable to sell that manuscript, they keep the manuscript and fire the agent. I did the exact opposite. I fired the manuscript. It will never be published. It was not ready for prime time, and kept the agent. And you know what? More than 60 books later, she's still my agent, and she sold all the subsequent books. So, you know, every word you write isn't golden. If you want to be a writer and you cling to every perfect statement, Well, good luck with that, because you're going to have editors who will hate your perfect work.
Right. Well, that is such a hard hurdle for a lot of people to get over, because writing can be so personal. It can be so reflective of who we are, and like you said, you know, there are lots of personal items in that first manuscript of yours, and a lot of times we're working out some of our own stuff in that book, and it just becomes too personal to be able to set that aside and say, no, this will never see the light of day. I'm going to do something brand new. That's a hard thing for some people to deal with.
And it was personal, because if you spend 60 days of your life being stalked by a serial killer, that's personal. And if you, and in that book, the fictional part was, I killed my husband in that book. And I didn't kill him. The serial killer came back and killed him too. And I gave him a wonderful funeral in the book. Well, I was divorced from my husband at the time I wrote that book. That was the only reason I could write it. I was divorced. And writing his death into that book was a real emotional release for me. And so, yes, it wasn't easy to walk away from that book, but it wasn't saleable. Nobody wanted to read that book.
Right. Well, and if it was an emotional release for you, then maybe the book served its purpose.
It absolutely did, in more ways than one, because it taught me how to write. Writing a 1,400-page book is the equivalent of writing 3 full novels.
Well, that brings up a great question. You were denied access to the creative writing course, but you did your own creative writing course in those early morning hours. And I know that this is an unfair question to ask, but do you feel like if you would have been in the creative writing course that things would have gone differently?
No. I think it would. I don't think I would have made the grade, because the creative writing courses I've encountered don't focus on popular fiction. They're all wound up on literary fiction. Well, Tony Hillerman told me once, Judy, literary fiction is where not much happens to people you don't like very much.
That's sadly true in a lot of cases.
And I think if I had, I've always read mysteries. I've always been interested in mysteries. And if I had gone to that creative writing class wanting to write mysteries, I think I might have had my ambition scrubbed right out of my soul. So actually, he did me a favor by not letting me in.
Right, right. Well, speaking of mysteries and your love for mysteries, do you remember what the first book was, or first series, or first author that really turned you on to the genre?
Of course. Carolyn Keene. Mm. Nancy Drew.
Oh, yeah. So many people give me that answer.
W.F. Dixon. The Hardy Boys. Yes. Of course. Those are the books that captured my interest when I was in fifth and sixth grade. By seventh grade, I was reading Zane Grey. And in high school, I was reading Mary Stuart and Victoria Holt. At one point in my life, I had a complete collection of John D. McDonald books, Travis McGee. And, excuse me, what I learned from reading those is Travis McGee never changed. He was the same in every book. He made the same bad decisions. He still lived in the same place. And so when I started writing Beaumont in 19, he was a character in his mid-40s, in the mid-80s. And he's grown since then, and he's changed since then. And I know Sue Grafton kept Kenzie Milhone in the 70s. But I'm very sorry she didn't make it to Z. I'm really sorry about that. But I could never have been Sue Grafton because I could not have stuck with one character in one era for all that time without being bored to tears, which is why I have four separate sets of characters. But my characters change over time. Time passes for them. That's what works for me.
Well, speaking of those characters, the character of J.P. Beaumont, whom you started with and whom is the star of the latest book, Sins of the Fathers, which is your 24th book in that series. Congratulations, by the way. Where did Bo come from, and why Seattle?
Well, I was living in Seattle at the time.
That makes it easy.
No, it doesn't make it easy because Bo is
the decision.
Bo is a Seattle native, and at the time I started writing about him, I had lived in Seattle less than 2 years, so I really had to do a lot of research to make that part of his life believable. But after I finished the first non-sold book, I started trying to write something that was fiction. And I tried for about 6 months and it just wouldn't go anyplace. So in 1983, for spring break, I sent my kids to Camp Orkilo up in the islands. And I put myself on a train to go to Portland and spend 5 days with a friend from my time in the life insurance business. And I got on the train with a stack of Blue Line notebooks and a fistful of ballpoint pens. And as the train pulled out of the station, I thought, what would happen if I tried to write this story through the detective's point of view? And so as the train got underway, I sat down and I started writing. She might have been a cute kid once. That was hard to tell now. She was dead. And from that moment, I was at the crime scene with J.P. Beaumont. I was walking around in his shoes. I was hearing what he heard, hearing what he said, but I was also hearing the thoughts in his head. And he and I have been character and author for going on 40 years now. And when I sat down to write Sins of the Fathers, within a couple of pages, I was back in his world, back in his mindset, and it was like putting on a comfy old robe and settling in front of the fireplace.
Oh, I love that so much. Do you still write out longhand?
No, my father was a life insurance man. And when I came dragging home with my then boyfriend at age 18, he looked at the guy and said, this guy is a raging alcoholic. And he said, oh, you're just teetotaler. So I spent 18 years of my life trying to prove my parents wrong. They were, of course, not wrong. But when we got married, my dad insisted that I take out a life insurance policy on him. And I did, a $50,000 policy, of which I was both the owner and the beneficiary. When he died at the end of 1982, he died a few minutes before midnight on New Year's Eve, I received that insurance policy proceeds. And I took 5,000 of that, and I invested it in an Eagle computer. It wasn't a laptop; it was a desktop, and a Daisy wheel printer. I invested 5,000 of the 50 in my future as a writer. And boy, is that was that a good investment or what?
Exactly. Wow. I had one of those daisy wheel printers in high school. Those were amazing.
Yes, well, try printing a 400-page manuscript from it.
That's going to take a little while. Oh, man. Tell us about your writing process a little bit. Are you a planner, a plotter ahead of time, or are you a discovery writer?
I met outlining in Mrs. Watkins' sixth-grade class at Greenway School in geography. I hated outlining in sixth grade. Nothing that has happened to me in the intervening decades has changed my mind about outlining. I write murder mysteries, so I usually start with somebody dead or verging on it, and I spend the rest of the book trying to figure out who did it and how come.
Wow. Do you, in writing like that, do you ever find yourself written into a corner, or find where the story's just not unfolding the way you want it to?
Often. It happens often.
Yeah. What do you do when you get in that situation?
Well, I guess the best example I can give you is in the book just before this was an Allie Reynolds book called The A-List. I've learned that the first 20% of the book is the hardest part to write. The next 40% is sort of like slogging through mud. But then when I get to 70 or 80%, then I'm on what I call the banana peel of the book. Because by then the characters are in place and I know where the book is going. And I just need to get all of the characters get to the same spot when it's time for the crashing climax.
You're just fighting to stay upright at that point.
So I was writing the A-list, and I got to 70%, and there's this spectacular car crash. And as a result of this crash, one of the characters in the book dies. And then the book stopped. Absolutely, utterly cold. So I went back to the beginning and I went all the way through it and then tinkered with it here and there, and I made corrections and did a lot of copy editing, and I got to 70% and the book stopped cold yet again. So I took a third crack at it. Got all the way to 70%, crickets. And that's when I realized that I had to change the hardest thing any writer ever has to change. I had to change my mind. And so what had happened is, with that character dead, the book was over without being finished. So I had to bring in the jaws of life. I had to drag that character out of the wreckage, transport that character to an emergency room, and then I was able to finish writing the book. That worked. And the A-List is a wonderful book.
I love that. Sins of the Fathers, the new book, is the 24th book in this Beaumont series, the J.P. Beaumont series. And you and I talked for just a second before we started recording about this being my first J.P. Beaumont novel that I've read, and coming in on book 24, what does that do to a reader? I absolutely loved the book. It was very easy for me to get in and get comfortable with the characters, and that's one of the primary things that I really want to talk to you about. How do you, when you're structuring a new book and you're working with characters that are so ingrained in your mind, in your process, how do you translate that to a new reader 24, books in? And I often remember back to something that Stan Lee said that he told the writers in his Marvel Comics bullpen when he was running Marvel Comics, was that remember that every comic you write is someone's first comic. And even though we've got these characters that have a long history, that every one of them is an entry point for someone. Is that something that you think about when you're writing? And if so, what do you do to ease people in?
I walk a tightrope because I Stan Lee didn't tell me that, but I understand that and understood that instinctively, that every book would bring new readers. So I have to put in enough of the backstories so that those readers will be comfortable without boring my regular readers to tears because they know all that stuff. And at the same time, I don't want to tell new readers so much of the backstory that they won't want to go back and read the previous ones. So it is a very fine line indeed.
Sins of the Fathers deals with not only is it a really great mystery, but there are a lot of issues that you're dealing with in this book. When a new book idea comes to you, how does it usually start forming? Is it a plot idea? Is it something that you want to do to a character? Is it maybe a headline that you've read that you think, oh, this would be a tantalizing thing to tease out? How does that creative process begin for you?
I can tell you exactly how this creative process began. 4 years ago, my husband and I went to see our doctor for our physicals, and he said, you have to start walking, because if you don't start walking, your husband is going to end up in a cart. Well, I knew that would kill him, so we started walking. And then our doctor, you give him an inch, he thinks he's a ruler, so we were walking. And since then, I've walked 10,000 steps a day for almost all days. And I've gone from a size 26 pants to a size 16. So it made a huge difference in our lives. But then he said, you need to go to a gym. And I said, like bloody hell. And so he found us a trainer. And Dan comes to our house every 3 times a week and puts us through a 30-minute workout. And it has made a huge difference. Yesterday on the plane, I was able to lift my luggage up into that overhead rack with no difficulty. But our trainer, we had a house in Tucson for a number of years, and we'd leave Seattle when it started to rain. We'd come back for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and then go back for March, April, and May. So, no, and I'm sorry, we'd go back in January, February, March, and come home the 1st of April. So that first year, we came back, and Dan came for our training session. And there he was on the course, a 66-year-old divorced man with an infant in an infant carrier in one hand and a diaper bag over his other shoulder. And that story is really Dan's story. His drug-addicted daughter left, abandoned her baby in the hospital, her drug-addicted baby in the hospital, and Dan spent weeks nursing her through withdrawal, getting her body weight up enough so she could be released from the hospital. And he raised that baby by himself for 9 months. He now has her living with a relative who is planning on adopting her, but the baby's father, biological father, is also a drug addict, and he is the daughter's boyfriend. The daughter's husband has been in prison for five years. So he cannot possibly be the baby's father. However, the state is dragging its heels on the adoption because they're trying to reunite the family. Give me a break. Give me a break. They won't allow the adoption until the guy in the slammer relinquishes his parental rights.
How ridiculous.
Don't get me started. So that that's where the idea for this story came from. And yes, it's a Beaumont book, but the real hero of this story is Alan Dale, Athena's grandfather. And well, sort of Athena's grandfather, because as soon as I read this book, I knew it had to have its origins in the fourth book in the series, a book called Taking the Fifth. I would have been so much smarter to name the fifth book Taking the Fifth. But the fifth in that story is the Fifth Avenue Theater. And in that story, Beaumont, who was a rip-roaring drunk back then, when I went back and had to read Taking the Fifth, I was astonished by how politically incorrect we were all back in the 80s. And when he hopped into bed with a perfect stranger, I was downright shocked. But he is not, because that guy was not the J.P. Beaumont I have grown to know and love today. So when the head carpenter from Jasmine Day's Bus and Truck Show shows up on Beau's doorstep with a baby and a diaper bag and asks him if they knew each other all those years ago. And he asks Beau if he will help him find his daughter so he can get her to relinquish her parental rights. Beau says, hey, do you have a photograph of this girl you want me to find? And Alan Dale pulls out a photograph and hands it over, and Beaumont looks at it. Whoopsie. You remember that one night stand from back in the 80s? Well, that girl in that photograph looks just like J.P. Beaumont's daughter, Kelly. And that is the first inkling he has that there ever was a baby. And so this is a mystery for him, but it's also a very personal mystery for him. And as far as I'm concerned, it's Beau's book, but Alan Dale is the hero. And there are so many people in this country today who, because of the opioid crisis that our government doesn't seem to notice, are not spending their golden years RVing around the United States or cruising the, doing river cruises on biking. No, they're going to PTA meetings and Pee Wee League and Little League because they are stepping up to the plate and raising their own grandchildren.
What a heartbreaking story, but in typical fashion, this is a gripping read, and it is entertaining from page one all the way through the end. J.A., I absolutely love this book. I love the character of J.P. Beaumont, and I'm going back and digging through your back catalog of those books because I just love this character so much. If people are just learning
about...
Oh, yes.
All in print.
Yeah, which is a major accomplishment in today's market. That is amazing. If people are just learning about you and want to dig into more that you do, and learn more about Beaumont and your other characters, is there a place online that they can find you and connect with you?
Yes, it's www.jajs.com. I publish a blog every Friday, and it's sort of a window on my world. It's what's going on in that week. It's what's come to my attention in the course of writing a book, or how I'm doing on writing a book. It's sort of like reading my autobiography in weekly installments. There are people out in the world who are what I call IORs, in order readers. And on the books page, clear over on the right-hand side of the screen, there's a downloadable list of all of my books in chronological order.
Excellent. We're going to put a link to that in the show notes. I'm sorry?
When I started in the writing business, he put the previous books in alphabetical order, and that didn't help anybody.
Right. Oh, we're going to put a link to all of that in the show notes. J.A., this has been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
You're welcome. And thank you for giving me 5 minutes to get a cup of coffee.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
On the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, Joey locked the doors of the Washington Irving Chapel and checked the windows from the outside, making sure that the cemetery offices were dark. Satisfied, he donned a knit cap and trudged uphill to the employee parking lot. He'd forgotten how desolate the grounds became at night. A fog had gathered, blurring the moon and stars. His rusty Volkswagen Beetle, christened Ladybug by Jason, sat in shadow alongside his dad's white van, which bore an image of the horseman and the cemetery's web address. Joey swept a palmful of condensation from Ladybug's windshield and fumbled for his keys. He heard a laugh, high and young. He froze. "Hello?" He shook off goose flesh and found his key. He started the engine and backed out, headlights off, praying not to knock over a headstone again. A child stood on the hillside amongst the graves. "You okay, kid? Cemetery's closed." He turned on his headlights. The child vanished. Joey idled in the drive, frowning. What had just happened? He turned off the headlights and waited for his eyes to adjust. The silhouette reappeared. The child stood in the road now, blocking his way. He and the ghost stared at each other. He bit his tongue and squinted over the steering wheel. He couldn't resolve the ghost's features, only a tiny body in ruffles? Yes, a dress. A little girl with shoulder-length hair. The figure crouched, threw its arms over its head and skipped away. A giggle followed after. The ghost skipped up the hill, turned around, and beckoned through the fog.
"Please come."
Joey shook his head. "No way. Ain't gonna happen." But he felt compelled to follow. What could a little girl do to him after all? He would keep a safe distance. The gravel sounded like soft rain beneath his tires. It drew him helplessly, past weeping cypresses and mausoleums blue with moonlight. He followed the giggle, the skipping ribbons, the little body made of shadow and quicksilver. The north end of the cemetery grounds rose to a steep wooded slope. The ghost had led him to Section 77, the northernmost boundary of the cemetery, but he'd lost her. He killed the engine, summoned his courage, and climbed out. The night air brought him fully awake.
"Where are you?"
he whispered, scanning the graves. A row of diseased hemlock trees stood at the fence line. Joey knew them well. They were dying, infested by some parasite called, he fished for the name, Woolly Addlegig. His crew had cut them back many times, lopping off limbs and heads, trying to save them. The hemlocks had grown back twisted and tormented. They stood as a row of grotesque sentinels guarding the threshold of the forest. The ghost climbed the slope, spun at the fence, and sat hugging her knees. The black mass of the Rockefeller State Park Preserve loomed behind her.
"What do you want?"
Joey whispered.
"Play."
He stepped forward, hands shaking. He just wanted to see her face, the face of a real ghost. To see the curve of her cheek, the sparkle that might have been her left eye.
"Come and play, Joey."
He froze. The sound of his name terrified him. She pointed over his shoulder.
"Play with us."
He turned and realized his mistake. He'd driven with his eyes on the girl, trying not to lose her, never looking behind. They had been followed.